Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who explains why she believes the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Treaty is the most potentially damaging agreement since the 1995 establishment of the World Trade Organization. Paul Anastas, director of Yale University's Center for Green Chemistry and Green Engineering, who talks about his recent trip to Antarctica, which coincided with the release of an alarming new report on climate change. And Josh Stearns with the media democracy group Free Press, who discusses a proposed Federal Communications Commission rules change that will weaken media ownership regulations to the advantage of giant media companies. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Facing an $18 billion pollution judgment in Ecuador, Chevron is ramping up its campaign of harassment against the oil giant's critics. In December, the company and its high-priced lawyers filed open-ended subpoenas against shareholder activist Simon Bilanes, the activist group Amazon Watch, and religious and social investors. Chevron also filed an ethics complaint against New York State Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli. For months, social investment groups such as Trillium Asset Management and the Unitarian Universalist Association have pressured Chevron to come clean with its investors about the risks it faces in an $18.1 billion Ecuadorian court judgment against the company for despoiling the environment in the Amazon rainforest. In May, several social investment groups wrote U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission Chairwoman Mary Shapiro, calling for an investigation of Chevron management and what appears to be an excessive cover-up of the risks faced by the company regarding this litigation. Chevron has pledged never to pay the judgment, but has lost a number of appeals in both the U.S. courts and Ecuador's appellate court. The subpoenas issued to the social investment groups demand confidential information on organizational strategy and documents relating to Chevron and the long-standing litigation in Ecuador. Amazon Watch called the subpoena a threat to its First Amendment rights. Claire Rembetz thought she had found the ideal house for her young family in suburban Hudson, Michigan. She received a tour of the property and talked briefly with the landlord's brother. 3 days later, the owner called back saying she wanted to visit the family to see how they lived in their current home in Dearborn, Michigan. During the visit, the landlord bluntly stated, "I notice you're a woman of color. Are you concerned about living in that area?" According to the U.S. Census, Hudson is 96% white. Rembetz is biracial and her husband is white. The landlord later emailed Rembetz saying the family could not rent the house due to credit issues and because of too many small children. Rembetz quickly contacted the Fair Housing Center of Metropolitan Detroit, which opened an investigation that included sending black and white testers with exactly the same credit histories to apply, yet only a white family was shown the home. In a rare enforcement action, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, filed charges against a property owner and won a $12,500 settlement paid to Rembetz. According to ProPublica, over 29,000 bias complaints were filed with HUD in 2010 alleging discrimination relating to race, family status, disability, or national origin. About two-thirds of those cases were handled by private attorneys and nonprofits which settled cases and in some instances filed civil lawsuits. The remaining 10,000 cases were referred to state, local, and federal agencies which together filed only 700 formal charges of discrimination. Altogether, in 2010, HUD only found 11 cases with reasonable cause to believe discrimination had occurred. The Department of Justice filed 29 cases, the lowest number since 2003. Advocates claim weak enforcement of fair housing laws leaves a racially segregated nation largely unchallenged, more than 40 years after the 1968 Fair Housing Act was signed into law. Many New Orleans residents were quite upset when the city's 175-year-old daily newspaper, the Times-Picayune, cut back its print publication to just 3 days a week, laid off 200 employees, and shifted its reporting of breaking news stories to its website. Hundreds of local activists rallied to save the daily newspaper, signing petitions and launching a boycott of what they now called the Sometimes-Picayune. According to the Christian Science Monitor, New Orleans is the largest city in the United States without a locally focused daily newspaper. However, the number of daily newspapers has shrunk in recent years as advertising dollars have plummeted. Media researchers have found that the declining number of local daily newspapers in communities has led to decreasing local civic participation while allowing government and corporate corruption to go unchecked and unchallenged. Now, there is growing talk of news deserts where local news reporting has completely disappeared. Media researcher Lee Shaker of Portland State University called local newspapers a public good we all benefit from, even if we don't read it, because it means journalists are pounding the pavement, holding public officials accountable, and activating the community. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is a proposed trade and investment treaty being negotiated in secret by 11 nations that includes the United States, Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. Japan has also expressed interest in joining the pact, however, that position was quite unpopular among Japanese voters in December's election campaign. The 15th round of TPP talks held in Auckland, New Zealand from December 3rd through the 12th drew militant protests. Despite growing opposition around the world, negotiators in New Zealand stated they hope to conclude a deal by the end of 2013. Although negotiations have been conducted under unprecedented secrecy, leaked documents reveal an agenda demanding aggressive intellectual property provisions which would roll back public health safeguards in favor of enhanced corporate patent and data protection. Critics charge those provisions would make it harder to gain access to generic drugs, such as retroviral drugs to treat HIV and AIDS. Other concerns center around the treaty's expansion of corporate power to challenge national laws on worker rights, environmental regulations, and consumer protections. While some 600 corporate advisors have participated in TPP negotiations, having access to drafts of the treaty's language, the public, members of Congress, journalists, and civil society have been excluded. Your reporter spoke with Lori Wallach, director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who was in New Zealand during the most recent round of talks. Here she explains why she believes the Trans-Pacific Partnership is the most potentially damaging agreement since the North American Free Trade Agreement and the 1995 establishment of the World Trade Organization.
Well, they serve a perverse irony because although people were divided about what NAFTA would do back in the 90s, the polling shows that one of the only things that actually unites the American public across Democratic, Republican, Independent, extremely conservative, extremely progressive, is opposition by majorities in each of those categories to more NAFTAs. NAFTAs actually united us in opposition. The reason, and I think if people knew about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, they'd be up in arms and there would be a debate. The reason they don't is unprecedented secrecy. This is a negotiation that has been going on since 2008, started by the Bush administration, took a hiatus in the end of 2009. The Obama administration picked it up. There have been 15 multi-week rounds of negotiations. There is a multi-thousands pages of draft text of 29 chapters of what really isn't a trade agreement. That's the brand that we're being sold. In fact, what it is an enforceable system of binding global governance written largely by and certainly written for the biggest multinational corporations. Think effectively NAFTA on steroids with Vietnam, China. It will be open for any country to join. And the chapters, of which only 5 of the 29 have to do with trade, include new rights for the big pharmaceutical companies to expand, to raise medical prices, expand monopoly patents, limits on internet freedom, penalties for inadvertent non-commercial copying, sending something to a friend. There are the same rules that promote offshoring of jobs that were in NAFTA, but much more robust, that literally give privileges and protections if you leave, There is a ban on Buy American and Buy Local or green or sweat-free procurement. There are limits on domestic financial stability regulation. There are limits on imported food safety standards and product standards. There are limits on how we can regulate energy towards a more green future. All of these things are what they call the behind the borders agenda. And the operating clause of TPP is each country shall ensure the conformity of its domestic laws, regulations, and administrative procedures with these agreements. That's to say we are told to conform all of our domestic laws, including all the important public interest laws fought so hard by people around the country, for these corporate dictates, and it's strongly enforceable. If we do not conform our laws, another country can challenge us and impose trade sanctions until we do, but this one is even privately enforceable by the corporations themselves. This is an agreement that actually formalizes the priority of corporate power over government. It allows any foreign investor to go to a United Nations or World Bank-based tribunal of three private sector attorneys and sue our governments for our taxpayer compensation over any domestic policy or action that the foreign investor thinks undermines their expected future profits. I could not make this up, and in fact, it would be hard to believe, except this is one of the few chapters that has leaked. This whole negotiation has been the most secretive I have seen in 20 years of watching trade agreements. Not even the members of Congress with jurisdiction directly over the agreement are being allowed to see the drafts.
Lori, what's been the role of the Obama administration in pushing the agenda, if at all, forward on the TPP talks?
Well, what's heartbreaking is, in fact, the Obama administration has, despite President Obama's really terrific promises during his 2008 campaign to replace the old NAFTA job-killing race-to-the-bottom model of trade agreements. In fact, the administration has recycled through into their trade positions many of the very people who got us into NAFTA during the Clinton administration. And those folks have picked up exactly where the Bush people left off, pushing this corporate agenda. And even more, which is just stunning, they've actually, in areas like pharmaceutical, big pharma's rights to expand patent lengths in poor countries, the Obama negotiators have actually rolled back reforms that the Democratic Congress made Bush include in some of his later trade agreements, which is just remarkably horrifying. But lock, stock, and barrel, the rest of it's just straight up the same old, except, you know, NAFTA on steroids. So NAFTA had certain elements of each of the rules that are in TPP, and TPP is the maximalist version of corporate power.
That was Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Find more information about the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Treaty and its critics on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. An alarming new report by researchers finds that temperatures in West Antarctica are warming at twice the rate than earlier believed and three times the worldwide global warming average, making that part of Antarctica one of the fastest warming regions on Earth. The paper released on December 23rd by the journal Nature Geoscience reports that the temperatures recorded at a research station in the center of West Antarctica have risen 4.4 degrees Fahrenheit since 1958. Scientists say that this data forecasts a potential breakup of the enormous ice sheet there, which could raise global sea levels by 10 feet or more in the next century. Paul Anastas, professor in the practice of chemistry for the environment at Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, just returned from a private trip to Antarctica with a group of other scientists. Anastas, who served more than 2 years as the science advisor to President Obama's Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson, was in Antarctica from December 7th through the 21st, which is the summer solstice in the southern hemisphere. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anastas soon after his return from Antarctica. He began by explaining the difference between land-based ice and sea-based ice as a factor in rising sea levels triggered by rising temperatures resulting from global climate change.
If you have ice that is floating on the water already, then you can think of it as ice in a glass of water. When it melts, it's not going to make the glass overflow. When you add ice that is on land that comes into the oceans, into the sea, that's going to result in far greater increase in sea level rise. So what we're seeing is there are both types in Antarctica where you do have ice shelves, which are ice that are on the water, but those often hold back some of the land-based ice, which would then be allowed to flow or melt into the seas.
Did anything surprise you or appall you or scare you, or was it pretty much as you expected?
Well, I think the same thing that most affected me was positively and negatively was the raw beauty of Antarctica. It's indescribable, and any pictures that anyone has ever seen of Antarctica can't begin to capture the raw beauty of the continent. The ice, the wildlife is just beyond words. And the thought of losing that or diminishing that is also the most distressing part of going to Antarctica. And when we see things happen like the loss of the Larsen ice shelf 10 years ago, and we start seeing the potential and ongoing collapse of the Ross ice shelf, which is even far larger than the Larsen ice shelf, which is about the size of the state of Rhode Island, we have to take seriously these latest reports about the rapid warming in the western part of Antarctica.
Are any of the scientists on this trip going to be writing a report, or did you do any actual measurements?
This trip, two things happened. There was the launching of what's known as an Argo float that goes into the Antarctic Sea to send back measurements via satellite to talk about the health of the oceans, both in the primary productivity with phytoplankton. There's also something more for the general public, which is down at the Palmer Research Station. A penguin cam was put in among nesting penguins for people to be able to tune into and watch the penguin life 24/7. So citizen scientists or just interested folks can tune into that when it gets finally set up and established.
Paul Anastas, I wanted to ask you about international cooperation in Antarctica. I remember when I was a kid, maybe 10 or 11, reading my dad's National Geographic about the International Geophysical Year focusing on Antarctica. I think it was around 1960, and talking about research teams from many different countries working there. Is that still true?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, what you just cited, the International Geophysical Year, was the launching of the International Treaty on Antarctica that had dozens of countries as signatories and parties to it that dedicated Antarctica to scientific exploration and conservation of the natural state of Antarctica. So there are numerous research sites from a number of different countries all around Antarctica that cooperate, you know, very intensively. In the U.S., it's largely sponsored by the National Science Foundation, but there are international bodies that coordinate this science.
As more ice melts in both Antarctica and the Arctic at the other pole, and also in Greenland, there's a big danger of creating a negative feedback loop, since ice reflects the sun's rays, but dark water absorbs more of the sun's rays. Did your trip give you a feeling one way or the other about whether we can ward off climate disaster, or do you think it's just too late?
I am glad that I saw the beauty of Antarctica, because it made me even that much more committed to recognizing that we need to preserve what I consider sacred places in the world, not only for their beauty, but for the survival of the planet and the ecosystem that we all inhabit as we know it. Action needs to be taken. In order to ward off the worst consequences, action needs to be taken immediately. There's the phrase that I've grown fond of, which is we need to manage the unavoidable and avoid the unmanageable. I cannot allow myself to think that it's hopeless, because pessimism doesn't motivate me to action, and so I call myself a strategic optimist, that if the right actions are taken, then the right outcomes can happen.
That was Paul Anastas, director of Yale University's Center for Green Chemistry and Green Engineering, and former EPA science advisor from 2010 to March of this year, who just returned from a two-week trip to Antarctica. Find more information on rising temperatures in Antarctica and global climate change on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an echo of a failed 2007 effort by the Bush administration, the Federal Communications Commission, under its current chairman, Julius Genachowski, an Obama appointee, will soon propose a change to the nation's media ownership rules that will permit the cross-ownership of television stations and newspapers in the 20 largest U.S. media markets. Media consolidation over recent decades has led to only 5 major companies owning the majority of the nation's television and radio stations, newspapers, publishing houses, and movie studios. Fewer media companies means less diversity of opinion on the airwaves and in print. While the Bush administration's ownership rules change under then-FCC Chair Kevin Martin was later repealed by the U.S. Senate and blocked by a federal court, the current effort may be approved unless the public is made aware of the consequences and mobilized to oppose it. Among the media giants that will directly benefit from the proposed rules change is Rupert Murdoch and his scandal-plagued News Corp. Murdoch is eager for new FCC rules that will allow him to purchase both the Los Angeles Times and Chicago Tribune, both based in cities where he already owns TV stations. Your reporter spoke with Josh Stearns, journalism and public media campaign director with the group Free Press. Here he explains why Free Press and other media democracy advocates oppose the proposed FCC rules change, believing that relaxed ownership regulations will be to the detriment of locally originated programming and reduce the diversity of views seen, heard, and read in a democracy reliant on the free flow of opinion and robust debate.
The FCC has pitched this as a relatively small change in the ownership rules. What they're trying to do is to gut the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban, which has been in place for over 30 years, really protecting local communities from creating local media monopolies. It's really a rule that's meant to stop local communities from becoming sort of a company town where one media company can really rule over and create a monopoly locally. And so what this means is that this ban has for a long time stopped one company from owning a newspaper and a broadcast television station. That's the most basic. But because of the way all the other laws are written at the FCC, if this one rule gets changed, it could result in one company being allowed to own the daily newspaper, 2 television stations, and up to 8 radio stations in your town. And that one company could even be your internet service provider, too.
Now, tell us about the involvement of the Third Circuit Court of Appeals when they gave the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, instructions on how to proceed with any future ownership rules changes.
Well, that's the strangest part about this story, is that these are almost the exact same rules that the Bush FCC tried to push through under Kevin Martin, Chairman Kevin Martin, back in 2007 and 2008. And what we saw back then, you know, in 2007, although we had massive public outcry, the FCC voted to cut this newspaper broadcast cross-ownership ban, and the Senate voted to overturn that rule. It never made it through the House at the time, but the courts took it up, and the Third Circuit actually tossed out the rule and told the FCC that they hadn't considered the impact this would have on media diversity, which is one of the FCC's congressional mandates, that they have to address localism, competition, and media diversity. And they had failed on that front, is what the court said. So they sent them back to the drawing board and said, don't come back and try to change these rules again until you've shown the impact that these rule changes would have on women and people of color owning the media.
Does the court have any recourse here in terms of the FCC not following their directions as it pertains to these new rules? Have they produced a study? Have they produced anything that the court has asked of them?
Well, after many, many years of waiting and calling on the FCC to do this, we now see that the FCC has produced a report a couple weeks ago that documents the state of media ownership in terms of women and people of color across the U.S. And the numbers are honestly staggering. We see women owning less than 7% of all broadcast outlets, while people of color control only 3.6% of television stations 8% of radio stations. And this is just a dismal level given, you know, the changing demographics of America, as we have seen in, you know, just in this recent election, how women and people of color carried Barack Obama to the White House. Now we see this decision that Barack Obama's FCC that may actually impact that and make that worse. But the FCC has done this study. They've told us now here's the status of media ownership and media diversity. But what they haven't done yet is analyze those numbers and how their rule change is going to affect that. Free Press has done that work, and we've seen and shown that changing this cross-ownership rule will actually mean less women and people of color owning the airwaves and make it harder for new stations to be bought by women and people of color. So we see that this is going to happen. The FCC hasn't fulfilled their mandate that the courts made of them. And so we have promised at Free Press that if the FCC moves forward again, we will sue them again.
The current FCC chairperson, Julius Genachowski, or Genachowski, is a Barack Obama appointee. And it seems like he's taken almost the exact opposite position of Barack Obama when he was running for office back in 2007-2008, that Barack Obama voiced his opposition to rules changes that would marginalize minority groups in terms of their ownership of our media. Seems to be a real disconnect there. Can you explain what's going on?
Yeah, it is a bit of a disconnect because when President Obama was Senator Obama, he actually led the charge to pass this resolution of disapproval and opposed these exact same rules that his FCC is now pushing forward. And not only that, but on the campaign trail, he made a promise to foster more media diversity in America and spoke eloquently about the need for media diversity in our communities and in the national debate and dialogue. And so it's been surprising for many people to see the road that this FCC has gone down. And in fact, the nonpartisan fact-checking group PolitiFact recently ranked President Obama's promise on media diversity as a promise broken because of all the evidence that the FCC is moving forward to actually allow more media consolidation.
That was Josh Stearns, Journalism and Public Media Campaign Director with the group Free Press. Learn more about the campaign opposing the FCC's relaxed media ownership rules by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.